actually come to some of these teachings in this series?
Yeah.
Oh, most of you. Okay. How many of you come to all of them? How many of you have come to one or more of the Mahayana teachings? Okay, so some of you have a little bit of a background maybe for that Zen context. Okay. So we're gathered here tonight in this very beautiful Dharma Centre, which Tina and her supporters have worked very hard, really, to provide for us and to sustain as a teaching centre. And we're very fortunate to have this in our local area. I mean, I'm talking about my local area. Some of you may come from other than Western Sydney, but I find it's a very wonderful thing to have in this area and available to so many people who probably traditionally haven't sought out more extensive Dharma teaching in Sydney. So it's a very great thing to have this. And of course, we come, I guess, wanting to learn more about the Buddha's teaching. Also to find some answers to our deep questions about the meaning of life, the nature of the universe, who am I, what am I, where do I come from, these questions. And these are perennial human questions, and for as long as human beings have been in community, these questions have been something that we've addressed, really. And in our ancestors, they would sit under the stars and ponder the skies and wonder about what was beyond. And other ancestors, they would sit around the fire. And, these questions are very deep questions for us. And so Buddha also had a great question. And that question took him to the foot of the Bodhi tree, and he sat under the Bodhi tree, holding this great question, really, and looking deeply into his mind. And that question, in a way, was, what's it all about? But in the sense of forming a very specific context around his question, he was wanting to understand the truth of suffering and the freedom, liberation from suffering. So he made a very great vow in himself to remain in that practice until he would either realize the truth or something else in life would intervene. So happily for us, he did actually come to know not only the cause of suffering, but also the way of liberation from human suffering, from the conditioned samsaric life. And so the great question is a very core consideration in the Zen path. In the Zen path, we're not so concerned with speech and words. In fact, for me, even to sit here tonight and try to provide you with some understanding of Zen is a bit heretical. Still, we've all turned up. So I will take the devil's part and try to give you a little bit of, not understanding, but perhaps help to point something towards what the Zen path is about. And you have to forgive me, I need to use notes because it's a little bit different from a Zen teaching tonight. And I understand that the teachings in this series have been very much about giving some orientation to how the various traditions and schools and practice forms have come about, and So I need also just to remember. My memory is not so good that I can recall so much these days. Some people are kind enough to say to me, that's because I've practiced a long time and therefore my mind doesn't hold all these petty details.
Keeping
They're very kind. Okay. So, the Buddha gives us a very, leaves with us a legacy of a very bountiful Dharma teaching, many, many teachings. We talk about the number 84,000. Have you heard that before? No? 84,000. I think it was probably a very big number in the time of the Buddha. So we refer to this number very often as a representative number for the number of Dharma teachings, the number of practices, etc., the number of paths. But we talk about this 84,000 teachings, and in their great variety and seemingly different in some ways. But we talk about them actually coming down to one. And in the Zen tradition, we talk about 84,000 teachings coming down to one, and that one is this big question: who am I? What am I? What's it all about? And this is really the core of the Zen path. It's a path of experiential, and the sort of words. I mean, the word Zen has captured the human imagination in a similar way, I guess, as mindfulness is currently capturing the human imagination. So Zen is something that everyone has heard of and has some idea about. But it is a path that actually comes originally from the Buddha's teachings back in the time of the Buddha. So the sorts of words that we might associate with Zen path: experiential, intuitive, disciplined, spontaneous, ordinary mind, everyday, nothing special. These are the sorts of words that people often use when they refer to the Zen path. But the Zen practice path also requires great courage and great vigilance and a sense of humour. It's a fairly pragmatic path. It's a down-to-earth path. We talk about Zen is every day. It's a way. It's not a concept. And Zen is not just about sitting on the cushion, as some people believe. It's about moment to moment, what's happening right now. And in the moment, we're required, in order to understand and attain the way of Zen, to put down our ideas, put down our beliefs, our judgments, our opinions, and be present to the moment, each moment, holding nothing. And this is the path of direct experience, the Zen path. So we don't seek to answer the subjective questions that are arising in the mind continually. There's questions about I. We do use the Zen path, obviously, to help us to work with the everyday experiences that arise. But we come to understand that the I, my, me is not really the central actor on the stage. So, Buddha tells us that that life, basically, life is a dream. It's a grand illusion. And each of us has our own epic drama. and which were at the centre. And we don't really know very much. We can't, don't really understand what goes on. We don't really understand even who the actors are on the stage. And many of them we don't even know. And you know, we make our own world, our own understanding. But Zen is a tradition, a practice that cuts through that. So a practice and a path that brings us in direct contact with reality, with life just as it is, without filtering it through the conditioned understanding, opinions, the judgments, the ideas about ourselves and the ideas about this and that. So, in trying to define Zen, it's a bit like trying to describe an orange. And I'm going to just hand this to you, and you're going to pass it on, and just take a piece. We can, if we're trying to describe an orange, we might talk about the colour of it, the taste of it, the scent of it. But if you just put it in your mouth and experience it, try it. Not scary. Just an orange. Now you understand. So what is an orange? No one came to answer. What is an orange?
It's possible.
Ah, not description. What is an orange?
That which we're experiencing that.
Not explanation. Is that there? Yum yum. So Zen is like this. It's about experience. And filtering it through ideas, through concepts, is a secondhand experience of life. So the Zen teaching, the Zen path, as I said, brings us into direct contact with ourselves and with life just as it is. So Zen meditation is a very disciplined practice of mind and body, and as I said before, it requires vigilance, and it's basically a very delightful encounter with oneself. And it's practiced not only while we're sitting on the cushion, it's practiced while we're walking, while we're standing, while we're lying down, while we're running, while we're dancing, while we're somersaulting. In all these ways, I mean, it is in this moment of where we are and what activity, what action we find ourselves in. That's the truth of Zen, and that's the truth of life in every moment. And so, in every moment, in every life encounter, we experience what the living of that moment, moment to moment. And this is the same path that Sakyamuni took, this direct path of coming to understand the nature of everything, coming to understand the truth of all existence and non-existence. So he sat under the Bodhi tree and he held this great question. And this great question took him deeper and deeper into his own mind, deeper and deeper into his consciousness, and in that process revealed layer upon layer, in fact peeled back layer upon layer of conditioned understanding, conditioned views. And Buddha was quite unusual in his day, because in the Hindu tradition, which he had been born into, and was the had been the prevailing religion in India for some 3,000 years before the Buddha, the path of practice was to escape from body. So in fact, the path of spiritual awakening was seen to be to free oneself from the physicality of existence. And the Buddha took an opposite direction. He just allowed himself to sink deeper and deeper and deeper into body, and in the process to reveal the truth of body, mind. And in that process he came to understand that everything is here in this body mind. When we turn our attention in and allow ourselves just to be present to what's arising in moment to moment, in the context of body mind, the whole of life and existence reveals itself to us. So when we talk about body in this sense, we think generally of this physical body. That's pretty much our common understanding. But this body has no boundary. Boundary is an illusion, really. And as we go deeper into a practice where we just allow ourselves to relax deeper into the meditation, to let go of any ideas about practice, any ideas of getting something from it, any ideas of going on a journey or a path or anything, we learn. Life teaches us. And we start to see that this sense of what we are is boundless. We see beyond this small self, this I. First of all, we move into, the terms that I use for body here are not absolutes. I use the terms in a way of just helping perhaps to point towards a path of practice. So when we think of ourselves in this body, this personality, this egoic structure, which is I or me. But beyond that is what we might describe as a relational body. So not only do we have this relationship to self as this personality, but we also have a relational connection with people and other beings around us. So this is the next kind of moving out into another dimension of who we are in this interconnection. So we're not singular, we're not separate. We're interconnected with everything. We're part of a whole. And as we move out past the relational body, we then move into the greater realm of what we might call the cosmic body or the universal body. So the truth of what we are is the whole as well as the one. And the Zen path really points very directly to the truth of this realization in ourselves. So Zen is also an attitude of spiritual awakening. It's the source from which all actions of daily life flow. So when we talk about Zen, we talk about it being a dynamic. It's not a static idea or process. It's a dynamism. It's in flow. And so the flow is our experience moment to moment. And this is all there is. all the ideas that we put on everything are, as we would say in the Zen tradition, like painting legs on a snake. So does a snake have legs? No. So a snake is just a snake. It has no legs. That's the reality of a snake. That's a snake nature, as we say. And so too, our nature is this nature that has no limits, that has no definition, that is just in flow, constantly in flow. So as I move, I'm going to move now into a little bit of the history of Zen, putting it in the context of the historical path of Buddhism. And as I do this, perhaps I just introduce to you one of the contemporary Zen masters in the Japanese tradition, Suzuki Roshi, Shunryo Suzuki. Has anyone heard of Shunryo Suzuki? I'm sure some of you have. So Shunryo Suzuki actually talks about beginner's mind. Have you heard of beginner's mind? So beginner's mind, I'll read what he says actually, so I won't paraphrase. So Suzuki says, in the beginner's mind, there are many possibilities. In the expert's mind, there are few. So I'll say it again. In the beginner's mind, there are many possibilities. In the expert's mind, there are few. So what Suzuki is saying here is, if you come to the moment, or come to this circumstance now, or to this Dharma talk, having a head full of ideas, having a great knowledge already, having an opinion about this practice or that practice, then there's a good chance that you're not going to get a whole lot from it. So if you let go of your ideas about it, if you just put them down for now, you'll pick them up later, no problem. They don't disappear just because you empty your mind for a while. If you just come here, just empty-handed in a sense, letting your mind just relax and open into the spaciousness of its natural way, and then just allow whatever of this talk touches you, or doesn't, it's okay. But let yourself be open to it. So when we're talking about the history of Zen, we have to begin by saying that Zen is actually a word from the Japanese language. So Zen is the word that is universally used, but in fact Zen comes from the word Chan, and Chan is a Chinese word, and it translates into Korean, which is my tradition, as song. And then in the Japanese tradition, it's known as Zen. So originally this word actually comes from dhyana, which is the Sanskrit word for meditation, and is the word used historically in the way of describing in a general sense, meditation in the Buddhist paths. So, when we talk about Chan history, we most often will think of a figure called Bodhidharma. Have you heard of Bodhidharma? Yeah. Have you seen pictures, calligraphy of Bodhidharma? Very interesting character. They say that in his practice he plucked out his eyelashes in order to stay awake, because in the Zen practice tradition we meditate with open eyes. And so when you see these drawings of Bodhidharma, he often has this very startled kind of look. Actually, no one really knows what Bodhidharma looked like. But this is a tradition of calligraphic expression that's taken its shape over many centuries. So Bodhidharma was actually an Indian. He was born in India, and he travelled to China around the 5th century or 6th century of the Common Era. And before this, Buddhism had already made its pathway, and those of you who've been here for the Mahayana talks, I'm sure, have already heard something of this historical transmission of the Mahayana through the North China, North Asian region. So Buddhism actually came to China around the 1st century of the Common Era, and probably even a little bit earlier, that it didn't really formally take shape until around the 1st, 2nd century. Of course, it came originally, travellers brought it on the trade routes. What was happening around the globe was there weren't newspapers in those days, and there certainly wasn't any electronic media, and so news was passed orally from travellers as they went about their work on the trading. But the Buddhism that had taken root in China at that time was it wasn't a really deep practice. It was generally about translating sutras that came from the Indian subcontinent. It was about building temples and monasteries. It was about supporting people to ordain, monks to ordain, and to practice. Building pagodas. There was a lot of emphasis in the early years of the visible signs of the Buddhist faith tradition, and I suppose in any new country that a religion, faith tradition travels, then each country or each region puts their own particular cultural stamp onto it, and so the architectural forms, the rituals, the language in many cases of practice of the Dharma are translated into the local cultural expression, and they also I guess there's also a fusing to some extent with the coexisting or the pre-existing faith or spiritual traditions in those regions and countries. So it's not surprising that Chan, as I'm going to talk about in historical context rather than Zen, in the Chinese context, took on a characteristic that is seen very much in Taoism. And so Taoism it came to light a couple of centuries after the Buddha, and it took root in China and in that region of China, Korea, Japan, and so you see a lot of the language that we use and the the practice devices and directions are reflective of that tradition. And also, of course, Confucianism, which was a major influencer in that region. And so you see in the outer forms of Buddhism in the Chinese, Korean and Japanese region are reflective of the Confucian forms and ethics and norms. So, for example, in my tradition, the Korean Zen tradition, the robes that we wear are reflective of the Confucian robes of the we call the Yangma. How do we call that in the intelligentsia, the intellectuals? How would we say that in the
like a scholar?
Sorry?
In like a scholar?
Scholars is one way of saying it. So the scholars, yes. Yes. The courtesans really. So yes, these robes actually come directly from that Confucian pathway. So while we have the outer trappings of any tradition, and in this case a path of practice, that doesn't really tell us very much about the practice itself. So these robes are representative of the many schools of practice in the Korean Buddhist tradition, not only the Son or Zen path. So Bodhidharma came to China, and he was a very developed practitioner, and as some would say, an enlightened arahat in a sense. And he came to China and bringing this particular practice tradition, which he had realized in his own kind of understanding and style, in a way, as a result of a very deep and sincere practice. And when he arrived, the emperor at that time, Emperor Wu, yes, I have to ask the Chinese here for pronunciation. Are you from the Chinese?
No.
You're
China.
Vietnam.
Vietnam.
Okay. Yes, of course, Vietnam. Ooh, yes? Ooh, Emperor Wu. Yes. So when he arrived, he met Emperor Wu. And Emperor Wu had been really looking forward to meeting Bodhidharma. He'd been waiting for him to arrive because he'd heard about this, you know, this very great master. And Emperor Wu was a great supporter of propagating Buddhism in China at that time. He had been a donor in having many monasteries built, temples, pagodas. He'd supported many monks in their life as practitioners of the Dharma. He'd has also supported many translations of the traditional historical sutras that were brought from India. And so he'd done very many great works, and he was very interested to hear from Bodhidharma what the merit might be for him for having put so much of himself and all of his resources into doing these great things for Buddhism. So he said to Bodhidharma when he met him, "Master, I have given my life to propagating Buddhism in China. I've made these great monasteries, I've built these pagodas, I've supported these teachers, etc., etc., etc. And tell me, what merit is there for me from this effort in this lifetime and in terms of an auspicious rebirth? What do you think Bodhidharma said? What might be his response? For those of you who know a little bit about Zen, what might he say? Well, he said none whatsoever. None whatsoever. Bodhidharma, I think, as we come to understand him, he didn't beat around the bush. He was fairly straightforward. You know, he wasn't too worried about the niceties of conversation. None whatsoever, he said. And just so I make sure that I represent him correctly. And then Emperor Wu said, he was a bit taken aback, you know, he was waiting for this confirmation, this affirmation of all this effort that he'd made. And when he heard this, you know, he was a bit perplexed by it. And so he said, what then is the most important principle of Buddhism? What then is the most important principle of Buddhism? And Bodhidharma answered, vast emptiness. Vast emptiness, nothing sacred. Mm-hmm. Vast emptiness, nothing sacred. Whoa! Master Wu was very much offside at that point. He wondered to himself, who is this? Is this the person that we've been waiting for? Someone else has got on the boat? And so he said to Bodhidharma, who is this that stands before me? Who is this that stands before me? And Bodhidharma answered, I don't know. End of conversation. Not much you can say after that, is there? So both of them were left fairly discontented at that point. Here we have Emperor Wu, who had been hoping for some strong, you know, kind of pat on the back, an affirmation, and, you know, some promise of a very good future rebirth. And there wasn't much that he received from Bodhidharma in that respect. And Bodhidharma, of course, had come, you know, with this wanting to really share this very profound teaching with the Chinese Buddhist community. But he also was deeply disappointed by this communication. And so he thought to himself, look, it's not time. It's not the time for this teaching in this place. And so at that point he crossed over the river into Shaolin. Shaolin is, some of you may have heard of Shaolin. Have you heard of Shaolin? What's special about Shaolin?
The fighting monks.
Ah, the martial arts, okay, yes. So we don't hear a lot about Bodhidharma in this context, but it is popularly known as a place of the martial arts practice among the Zen monks. But anyway, he didn't go looking for these particular monks. He went and found a cave in a very remote region, and he basically, if you can, closed the door of his cave, and he sat down facing a bare wall and remained facing the wall for 9 years. Decided there's no point. I'll wait for conditions to change, for opportunity to ripen. And so that's what he did. And after some time, he continued just on his own in this recursive way to practice. And then one time, well, people came and people came and they knocked on his metaphoric door and said, come, please tell us about Buddhism. And he said, go away. You can't understand. Stupid, go away. You can't understand. So people, would go thinking, very strange one, that one. Until one day, in the middle of winter, and this was a very remote region in China, in the mountain area, and it was the middle of winter, and very deep snow, and conditions are pretty challenging. And on this occasion, a young monk came, and he really had a sincere wish to learn from Bodhidharma. And so he knocked on the door and he said, "Master, Master, please, come and please. I want to learn from you. I want to be your student." And Bodhidharma just completely ignored him. Just let him continue to knock for a while, just completely. He thought, "What's the point? There's no point. I'll just raise his expectations and then, they'll plunge again because he won't be able to understand." So he didn't respond. Anyway, this monk, he continued standing outside the door, right all through the night and into the next day. And you can imagine, it was snowing heavily. Temperatures were well below zero, much lower than anything that we ever experienced in Australia. And this monk continued just standing and waiting, hoping that Bodhidharma would respond. And when Bodhidharma came out the next day and looked out the window or whatever, out the
this is a really nice cave.
And he saw this monk still standing there, nearly dead from cold. And he said to him, "Go away, you'll die if you stay here." And this monk said, "Please, Master, have some compassion. I sincerely seek to understand the way." And Bodhidharma came out of the cave and he stood before him and he said, "You're wasting your time." And at that, the young monk pulled out a very sharp knife, which the monks carried in those days to use for all sorts of things, including, food preparation and making shelters and robes. It's one of the requisites in the monk tradition. So he pulled out this knife and he slashed his arm. They say cut his arm off, or he certainly made a mess of it. And with that, of course, he was deeply, deeply suffering. Not only in mind as he'd been suffering, but in body as well. And he said, "What else can I do to show you my sincerity in seeking your teaching?" And Bodhidharma had to have some compassion at that point. And so he said to the monk, and the monk called out to him, "Master, Master, please take away this terrible pain. This pain is unbearable." And Bodhidharma said to him, "Show me that pain. Where is that pain?" And the monk said, "The pain is in my mind, in my body." He said, "Show me the pain. Show me your mind." And the monk, he searched and searched and he said, "I can't find it." And he said, "Yes, that's how it is." And then in that moment, this monk understood. I won't say what he understood, because that's part of the Zen practice. If I tell you, I'm giving you a lie, because understanding is not something that I can tell you. It's something that you must arrive at through your own deep consideration of such a situation. So that's a koan. Have you heard of a koan?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyone not heard of a koan?
Brenda loves asking me these koans.
Riddles?
Yeah.
Are they like riddles?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
and a story.
So koans are a very very common device that we use in Zen practice. And they are like a riddle, like a conundrum. They can't, can be answered, can provide an answer through through using the internet, but it's not really
using the internet.
What are you saying?
Did you say using the internet?
Intellect.
Oh,
okay. What did you think I said?
Using the internet. That is a very modern way of doing it.
Very similar. I'm sure many people go online looking for koans on the internet, and I'm sure they find them too. But the whole point of the koan is that the answer is individual. So there's no one answer to a koan. The answer is your answer, and that comes with taking it, just holding it lightly in your practice, in your life, and letting it just permeate deeply into the mind, into the body, and then in time, mostly, an answer will arise spontaneously, intuitively. And that answer may not be in speech and words in your head. It may be in an action, it may be in something that you suddenly see, it may be it may be in a feeling, it may be in any number of ways, but you will know, you will understand in that moment, now I understand. But if you try to speak it, to explain it, you'll have great difficulty. Because the moment you move away from that direct experience, you've already lost it. So this is the deep wisdom that the Buddha speaks of that arises when we contemplate the mind and we let go of ideas and opinions and this and that and allow the true mind to reveal itself. So, Bodhidharma, as I said, was a pioneer of the Dhyana in China, and it was known in those times as Chana, and Chana was the word, the Chinese word, or the Chinese pronunciation of Dhyana. And he was known as the first patriarch of Zen, or of Chan in that time, but actually there's an example that goes back even earlier in the time of the Buddha that we might see in a way as the beginning of this practice path, of this way, the Zen way. And this was in a conversation, or not a conversation, not a, a speech conversation, but was in a communication that happened between the Buddha and Mahakashyapa. And have you heard of Mahakashyapa? So Mahakashyapa was the principal disciple of the Buddha. And he was an older man, and he didn't actually come to the monkhood until he was older. And on this occasion that I'm going to speak of, he wasn't a monk at that time. And so this conversation or communication takes place in a place called Vulture's Peak in northern India. And this was one of the usual kind of places or meeting grounds for Dharma talks. And so the Buddha would come to a particular place, and people would gather to hear his Dharma. And many people came, and not only humans, but other beings came to hear this very deep wisdom of the Buddha. And on this occasion, as on most occasions probably, the Dharma took place in an outdoor setting. They didn't have metta centres in those days. They didn't have soft cushions to sit on and cups of tea being made for them. And it was just a la natural. And so this was one of these occasions. And So the Buddha arrived and people had already were already sitting, waiting in anticipation, and he sat down on the higher position as the teaching position, probably a little bit up on a hillside. A lot of hillsides and mountains in the northern part of India. I'm sure some of you have been there and know this. And he just sat very quietly, not speaking. He continued to sit for quite a long time. And the people were not used to this. You know, they were waiting and they'd come a long way, some of them, and they were waiting in anticipation of receiving the Dharma. I started to become a bit restless. I think, what's going on? Why is the Buddha speaking? Buddha continued just to sit. And finally he reached down, and I guess it must have been spring or summer, and there were flowers growing in the field and in the meadow, and he just picked a flower and he raised it up above his head, held this flower up above his head, still not speaking, silently held this flower up above his head, looked out among the people. People were going, what's going on here? Very strange, no. He continued just holding the flower above his head. And of all the gathering, probably many hundreds of people on that occasion, there was one person right down the back. And this person looked directly at the Buddha and held the Buddha in his attention. And then this great grin came on his face. Very wonderful smile. And the Buddha saw this. And then he spoke. And he said, I bequeath the whole of my Dharma, the whole of my Dharma legacy to this person, to Mahakashyapa. He wasn't actually known as Mahakashyapa then, but I can't remember. He was Kashyapa, I think. Maha came later. Maha means great. So I don't know if he was even Kashyapa at that time. But anyway, there was this man down the back, sitting right down the back, you know. And he said, this Kashyapa is the sole heir to my Dharma. So the question, this is another koan, you see. Zen is full of koans. The question that we ask in relation to this is, what did Mahakashyapa, why did Kashyapa inherit? What was it that the Buddha gave him? What was it that the Buddha understood in this smile? What was it that Kashyapa understood when the Buddha held up this flower? This is a very interesting koan to take into the practice. But anyway, this was what we would think of as really the first recorded occasion of a Dharma encounter that was a forerunner really for the Zen path at a later time. And the other thing that this occasion shows us or reflects for us is the transmission from teacher or master to disciple, master, disciple, teacher to student. So in this case, the Buddha, mind to mind, we say, was transmitting all of the Dharma to this one person, Kashyapa, who in his very action of making that opening really to that moment, being fully present in that moment, in allowing that transmission, became a lineage holder in the tradition. And so we talk about, in the Zen tradition, lineages. And Bodhidharma was the first patriarch of the Zen path, and was the first, as we say of Chan, was the first lineage holder, but we may say that Mahakashyapa in fact preceded him. So Bodhidharma actually describes the essence of the Chan approach in this way. Chan is a special transmission outside the scriptures. It does not depend upon words and speech. It is a direct pointing to the mind and seeing into one's own nature, thus attaining Buddhahood. A special transmission outside the scriptures, not depending on speech and words, directly pointing to mind, seeing into one's nature, thus attaining Buddhahood. And so we can see in this in these two occasions, one of the encounter between the Buddha and Mahakashyapa. It was there were no words spoken. There was no there was no scripture delivered. There were no instructions. There was just this, in this moment, right now, complete 100% encounter between the Buddha and Mahakashyapa. And in this encounter, there was a transmission of the whole of the Buddha's mind to Mahakashyapa. Now, what that means is very interesting, because as I describe that in words, it's really not possible, it's rubbish. So it's something, again, that we can only really understand in our practice. But we try with speech and words to point towards it. So this person that came and spoke with Bodhidharma, asked for his teaching. His name was Heck, and I think the Vietnamese say Heck. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the Koreans say Hey. Vietnamese say Hai or Hue. Hue.
What's what?
Hue. Hui. Hue. The Vietnamese say hue.
It's whisper.
It's
mean whisper.
Yes. The Koreans say hey. And the Chinese.
Hue.
Also hue.
Yeah. Okay.
So hue was this the name of this this young monk who came looking for the Dharma. And so in this encounter with Bodhidharma, he also, his mind completely opened up, and he realized the truth of all the Dharma. And so he became the second patriarch of Chan. So he was second in this lineage holder, in this lineage path of Chan. And Bodhidharma actually talks about two gateways into enlightenment. And this is or two entrances into enlightenment. And the two gateways is a term that you'll hear a lot in the Zen tradition. And we often talk about koans as gateways from the conditioned mind into the unconditioned. So in this sense, we talk about, Bodhidharma talks about two gateways. One is the principle path, principle gateway, and this is a path of sudden enlightenment. So it's a sudden, instantaneous, spontaneous awakening to full enlightenment. So that doesn't mean that it happens without a practice path. But in the sudden enlightenment path of Zen, we talk about you're either enlightened or you're not enlightened. Enlightened. There's no part enlightened. So in the way of this path, we talk about, we may practice for many, many years, and we may never, in that lifetime, achieve that waking up, that full understanding. That doesn't mean that practice is not just because we haven't attained the fullness of awakening. It doesn't mean that it's a waste of time. It's an ongoing journey in a sense. If we're fortunate enough to be born into a form and a situation where we can again practice the Dharma, then this prior practice is awakened again in us. So this principal path is the path of direct realization, without reliance on speech and words, without reliance on concepts and doctrines. He also talks about the gradual path of awakening. And this gradual path of awakening is the path of coming to accept karma, to understand karma, to accept our karma, to adapt to the conditions of the mundane realm. It's come to realize the path of non-seeking, and eventually to become one with the Dharma. So these two paths are both practice paths within the Zen tradition. And Bodhidharma's particular path was one of sudden enlightenment, and my tradition, which is the Chogyodong, or Chogyo order, is a Son tradition, or Zen tradition, and it's a sudden enlightenment school. So in my practice path, there's no halfway. You're either enlightened or you're not. So our practice is a very strong practice, and we make we're encouraged to make use of in our younger years of strong body, strong mind, and we go we spend at least 6 months of the year in very singular practice, so 2-3 month periods, one in winter and one in summer. And during these times, we go to special meditation halls, and no one else is allowed to enter that precinct during that 3 month period, only those who have committed to that practice season. And during that time, it's really we sleep little, we eat little, and we do formal practice for very long hours. So we may sit on the cushion in a meditation context for 14, 16 hours a day. And then we have our meals, our formal practice again. And so most of our day we spend sitting in a meditation hall, facing a wall in the same way that Bodhidharma did, and with all of our other fellow practitioners around us. And that can become sometimes very difficult because the mind has all sorts of likes and dislikes and wants and not wants, and so sometimes our neighbour, we see is direct from hell. We wish they'd go back there. So You know, it's a very strong practice, unlike the Theravada practice, which of course is a strong practice also, but is often, you know, the solitary practice of, the alone practice. The Zen practice is a practice that we can't really do alone effectively. It's a practice of the group practice, the group mind. So we try to use those years when we've still got, you know, the strength, the physical strength, and you know, the very strong mind of younger years, to really push ourselves in the practice, and push ourselves in a way of not pushing. Doing the practice in a way of not doing, sitting in a way of not sitting, bowing in a way of not bowing. All of these ways of really, you know, learning the way of meditation. And the way of meditation, the way of Zen, as I've said, is natural. And so we spend many years really trying this way, trying that way, bashing our heads against this, you know, contorting the body, doing all these, you know, things of trying to get it, trying to push through. And through that, you know, that persistence and that, you know, that just that sincere wish, you know, that desire or that affirmation of really wanting to move beyond this suffering mind, then we begin to let go into the truth of meditation, which is a very natural way. So, you know, the part that what we are really, it's really what we are, this way of meditation, this way of flow of the Zen path. But it takes, you know, quite a lot of time before that wisdom arises in our mind, before we let go of trying to do it, trying to get it, trying to make it happen. So this is the style of practice in our tradition, and we during that 3-month period, we keep you know, a fairly solid silence, and we really just focus as much as possible on what's going on inside us, not worrying so much about what's going on out there. But of course, as I said, the mind, you know, has its way of pulling us out, and you know, sometimes we find ourselves, you know, caught again in that very powerful conditioned mind, the egoic mind that doesn't really like sitting here and waiting and being present and just allowing life to reveal itself. So, after the second patriarch, Heck, we have a third patriarch of China. Again, this is the Chinese, in the Chinese lineage. And his name is Seng Khan. And he doesn't really make a lot of waves in the sense that there's a lot of history about him. But he does leave a legacy in verse, which is a very formative teaching in the Zen Song Chan tradition, and this is just an excerpt from it, and he says, "The supreme way is not difficult if you only do not pick and choose. The supreme way is not difficult if only you don't pick and choose. Neither love nor hate, and you'll clearly understand. The supreme way is not difficult if you do not pick and choose, neither love nor hate, and you will clearly understand. And you're smiling.
Are you going to pass on your Dharma legacy? Yeah.
Your flowers on the side.
What is it that you understand?
Well, are you talking to me?
Both of you?
I'm so, you go first.
You take a big risk here. I've got this stick, which is part of our... Please, don't be intimidated. So what does this point to, do you think? What do you understand? It's okay, say whatever.
I'm not very good when I'm put on the spot. No. Sorry.
So, that's okay. My teacher, my own teacher would say, that answer is very good, actually. Well, not in the sense of being self-conscious, but not making the mistake of trying to answer the question. So my teacher would often say to me, and often to the few Westerners who were going to venture into the Korean Buddhist diaspora, open mouth, big mistake. So you're very wise. So Brenda, would you like to have a go? Okay. So again, just using speech and words. What is this pointing to, really? It's pointing to the mind of duality, isn't it? If you have a mind that holds this and that, love, hate, day, night, etc., then you will suffer. If you put this mind down and just be in the one mind in this moment, then there is no suffering. It's this mind of duality, this mind that we hold on to, that is the suffering mind. So, listen to it again. The supreme way is not difficult if only we do not pick and choose. Neither love nor hate, and you'll clearly understand. So when you can just be in this moment, not wanting this, not wanting that, not wanting this, not wanting that, but just be present to whatever and just be with it. Because that's what is. That's all that's here in this moment. And that's complete in itself. Then that's enough. And that is this in that moment, this is the realized mind. Simple, not special. The idea of the practice path being some very special accomplishment or enlightenment being some great achievement that only some people can attain. It's really the greatest secret. In this moment you can completely awaken. In this moment, if you can just put down your ideas, your opinions, your judgments, put down all this stuff that goes on in the mind constantly, just let it be, not attaching to it, then in that moment you're awakened. Hard to believe, isn't it? But you don't have to listen to me. You have to take the path of practice to find that in yourself. So after the third part, patriarch, we're going to skip the next two, fourth and the fifth, And we're going to come to the sixth patriarch, Benenun. Benenun is a very important one of the great teachers and patriarchs in the Tang tradition. He's also the first patriarch in the Korean lineage and in the Vietnamese lineage, the Zen lineage. And so he was, his teaching was transmitted to the Korean Buddhist context, and so his style of teaching, his style of practice is what we in Korea, in the Song tradition, practice today, and is also the practice path in Vietnam. I think actually the Vietnamese Zen tradition came from Korea, is that right? Or from China and
from
Korea?
From China.
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 Okay. So, Heinen, he wrote a very seminal work on Chan, the early Chan writings. Heinen has a very interesting experience of enlightenment. He was a peasant boy, literate, had no experience of the scriptures, had no formal education. He was just a boy of about 12 or 13 when he encountered the Dharma, and he was walking across an outdoor courtyard, and you could hear the people reciting the Diamond Sutra, Anarod speaking, and the words that he heard that had a big impact on him were, abiding nowhere gives rise to mind, allow this mind to rise. Abiding nowhere, this is a very interesting a pointer to the way of practice in the Zen path. Abiding nowhere gives rise to mind, allow this mind to rise. And so abiding nowhere suggests that the enlightened mind, in the enlightened mind, is not, it's not blank. It's not that we transcend this flow of thoughts, of arisings in the mind. It suggests that in the enlightened mind, this flow remains. So thoughts come, thoughts gone. Thoughts arise, thoughts depart. This is a natural process of mind. We don't have to empty the mind in a true sense of getting rid of thoughts. And if you ever try to do that, you'll realise that it's a foolish endeavour. That in fact, by trying to rid your mind of thoughts, you create more and more thoughts. This grasping in itself is the problem. So in the enlightened mind, Hanung understood that this flow of ideas, of thoughts, of impressions, sensations, feelings, is a continuing flow that we don't, neither can we stop, nor do we need to even try. But in the enlightened mind, the mind that is abiding nowhere, the mind that is not attaching anywhere, not attaching to thoughts, not attaching to feelings, not attaching to this, to that, to experience, to concepts, is abiding nowhere, holding nothing, just being in the flow. In that mind, there's thoughts and feelings, impressions, sensations, are still there, but they're not stuck to us. They're free flowing, and we experience them with the enlightened mind as if they're reflected in a mirror. And so you find that this mirror is another common teaching device used in the Zen tradition. We talk about mind as mirror, as a practice, a way of practice. So we don't abide anywhere, and we don't collect anything, and we don't get stuck to anything. We just let whatever's arising arise, not interfere with it. Just be part of the flow in that moment. And in this way, the enlightened mind remains free of attachment, free of discrimination, free of vexation that this mind, this don't like mind, in the midst of activity. And so this mind, even in the flow of thoughts and feelings and sensations, etc., functions as wisdom. So this mind, in the enlightened sense, comes not from this samsaric, conditioned flow of ideas and the habitual mind. This mind that we speak of is a deeper aspect of mind. It is the mind of that arises from emptiness, the sunyata as we speak of. And this is the wisdom mind. So we practice, really, we take this path in order to realize the truth of wisdom, the truth of compassion, which is already in us as the original mind, or we may say Buddha nature. And Buddha nature is another key concept in the Zen teaching. So Buddha nature is original mind. So this mind that we think of, this I, my, me mind, me, you, is actually, as I said before, a false mind. We all have this seed of Buddha nature in us. And there's nothing really to do except to peel back this conditioned mind that we've developed over lifetimes. This mind that's established a whole kind of armour around ourselves. All kinds of views, all kinds of ways of seeing the world, of seeing ourselves, of seeing each other. And the way of practice is to, like the onion, as we talk about, peel back the layers of false understanding to reveal the original mind. And this original mind is the mind, the Zen mind. This is the mind, this is the enlightened mind, and this is the mind that abides nowhere, that holds nothing. Okay. Are you with me?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Difficult?
Yeah.